It's my favorite way to start a weekend. Coast to Coast AM. In for George Norrie. This is Ian Punnett. And listen, you know, it has been one of these weeks, I think probably for everybody, when we're beginning to feel maybe a little bit like, bring on the alien buffet. Maybe you should eat Americans first. To all of the aliens hovering silently behind their cloaking devices just outside of Earth's atmosphere, I'm beginning to feel like I'm willing to volunteer to be an appetizer. But we got to hold it together. We just got to hold it together. You know, this 2020's got to break at some point, if nothing else, for 2021. And let's hope that it does. I want to say hi to Orion Samuelson. He's not hearing this as we speak, but anybody in Chicago knows his name. Legendary broadcaster Orion Samuelson is retiring after years and years of work for WGN radio and television. I had a chance to work with him as an adult, but even as a kid, I remember getting up early before they were showing the standard kind of you know, children's programming on WGN in the morning. Ray Rayner and Friends was the guy's name. And there would be Orion Samuelson on doing Farm Reports with Orion Samuelson. And he was just such a wonderful man to know later on. He was every bit what I hoped he would be. But back in the old days when he was wearing his Buddy Holly glasses and on the set of WGN TV doing Farm Reports while an organist sat nearby and provided accompaniment. Early television at its best. And the graphics, oh my God, they were just, you know, on a screen, you could just see the person, you could almost feel their hand as they were moving the wheel of the graphics across the screen. I'm glad I didn't miss that era, but at the same time, I don't miss that era. But I will miss Orion Samuelson and knowing that he's on the air somewhere, and I hope he's healthy. And thank you for everybody who sent me messages at Deacon Punnett on Twitter to tell me about him. Really enjoyed the man and the poncho to his Cisco, Max Armstrong, who also shared the air for a long time. As long as I'm giving a shout out on George's time, I'd like to thank Coast to Coast affiliate KNSI in St. Cloud, Minnesota. They run Coast to Coast all week. Matt, Todd, Justin, Jennifer, who are all in the news department, were recently joined by one of my students from K-State, Danae Dryden, who is now a news anchor and reporter for KNSI. So should you bump into any of those people, let them know I gave them a shout out. And of course, as always, thank you to our local affiliate where I am at K-State. K-Man is the radio station here. But all the affiliates across North America, you're in for a great show tonight as we inch our way toward Halloween. In fact, I'm doing the Halloween show on October 31st, which I'm very excited about. But as we get closer to Halloween, we're going to start hearing more and more of these classic coast-to-coast topics coming up. And we have one tonight from a guest that I enjoy talking to both on and off the air regularly. ML Berman is an author. He is a video producer. He makes great YouTube products, and hopefully someday you'll see him on the big screen too. But he sent me a photo. He texted me a photo earlier this week of some footprints he found in the sand when he was out cruising the Mojave. And if you go to the website, coasttocoastam.com, you can click onto related images underneath tonight's show, and you'll see what we're talking about, and you'll hear him talk about it next on Coast to Coast AM. In for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so if you go to the coasttocoastam.com page, right, and you click on tonight's show, Desert Strangeness / Open Lines, and we'll slash through some open lines coming up later on. You'll see links to ML Behrman's various work. For example, his website, his YouTube channel, and to his book, which, by the way, I like quite a bit. I found it, his nonfiction book. Then he's got fiction books, too, which are always fun. But I found Mojave Mysteries on my desk the other night. I was cleaning off my desk, and I found it. ML, and I'd forgotten how much I dog-eared it and highlighted different passages in it. It's such a fun read. And it's a great accompaniment for the show tonight. It's nice to have you back on Coast to Coast.
Well, thank you very much, sir. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, man, you rock. So ML and I talk all the time, and he sent me these photos. Before we get to that, I mean, I encourage you to go look at them. Again, under tonight's show, Desert Strangeness, click onto that the parenthetical link. It just says related images. But before we do that, for people who have missed your previous appearances on Coast to Coast, you have an interesting story to tell in that you didn't set out to do what you've found great success doing. You went to Hollywood. You were going to be a scriptwriter. You did work on different products over the years in Hollywood before you made it back to the desert. Just to explain that transition so people know a little bit more about you.
Well, I had come to Hollywood, like you say, to try and be a writer and also work in the art department because I was really into model making and stuff like that. And I got on a show that was going to do paranormal stuff, and they were going to shoot some of the episodes out in the desert, out everywhere from Palmdale to Joshua Tree to up in the Mojave Preserve. And I started coming out, and I just fell in love with the area. The show ended up not going anywhere, but I loved it so much that I actually bought a house out here because it was cheaper to buy a house in the desert than it was to live in an apartment in Hollywood.
I bet. And,
you know, at first I thought I'd made the worst choice of my life because I'm like, oh my God, I'm on the far side of the moon out here. but then I just, after a couple of weeks, I'm like, oh, I'm home. You know, I just love this area. And I've always been a history buff, and going out and exploring the old mines and talking to people that were prospectors or ranchers or whatever, I started to hear stories from them. Now, I had always thought that the desert was strictly, you know, the background for a Western. You know, it was going to be cowboys and Indians and miners and ranchers. But then I started seeing and hearing how weird it was and how many people had a story. It was like everybody had a story, you know. And I just started collecting them. And not with the idea of doing a book, just because I thought, you know, it might be material somewhere down the line. And the more I got, I actually started going out and trying to look into some things and had a few experiences of my own that were really weird. And so I decided, well, you know, this is almost like an uncharted territory for a lot of people. Now, there are people that have written stuff and do radio shows about the desert, but the stories seem to be the same three or four stories recirculated a million times.
Right.
I wanted to find out different stuff, and then I, being a historian, I'd go look at the old archives of newspapers and journals and stuff like that and find out that a lot of these phenomena have a pedigree that goes back 100, 200, 300, 400 years, you know, back to Native American times, and that they also seem to cluster around certain areas. And I just started getting more and more into it and more following the story. So I decided, well, I'll do a book and then I'll start doing some videos based on stories in the book and just try and, you know, develop the idea around it. And I always say it's I always imagine myself as like the old nobleman who has the cabinet of curiosities, you know.
Right.
Like, okay, come look at this skull I found or look at
right.
this weird thing or, you know. And the desert, to me, is just one giant cabinet of curiosities.
Yeah. But you also started writing the fiction series,
well,
which is really cool.
Well, thank you. I came up with the idea of this monster hunter from the 1800s, you know, a cowboy who goes and takes up different jobs to track down creatures that at the time he didn't know what they were. And I would get it from, like, I spend a lot of time out by myself in the desert at night camping, and I would kind of sit, you know, there on the rocks at night and think like, oh, wow, wouldn't it be scary if you were like, you know, a cowboy out here and
right.
you were on the trail of something. So it just became great fodder and atmosphere for additionally what I was doing.
Well, I love that it's sort of Zane Grey meets Coast to Coast, and it's a fun vibe, and people who like that type of fiction should, well, even just people who like good fiction should read those books. But, and you can find out more by linking up to him at his website or Amazon or any place where books are sold. But it, the YouTube channel is fun. And that's where I found you originally when I was doing research on murders in the Mojave and came across your work that way. But this new thing is pretty captivating because the tradition of a Bigfoot, like you mentioned, has a strong Native American association. I just didn't realize that the tradition could somehow be associated with that part of the desert. I think of it as being that if we're going to be looking at tracks of a Yeti of some sort, that it's going to be in more wooded areas, not, you know, in the open. And if I'm Bigfoot and I'm hairy and I don't want to be in 125 degree heat. So, I mean, that's part of it too, is I think I would never have expected this part of the story.
Well, exactly. When I first moved here, one of the very first experiences I had was I hired a old prospector to take me around and show me, you know, what a prospector looks for, because I was kind of wanted to research gold mining and all that.
Yeah, why not?
And I took him out, and I've told this story before, so I won't go into the long version, but we were taking a break, and he told me that he used to be a man tracker in the Green Beret in Vietnam, and he did three tours. And, you know, that was fascinating because he was pointing out all these tracks to me. So I made a joke about Bigfoot because I'd taken my boot off and stepped in the sand, and I got size 12 feet. So I went, hey, Bigfoot. He's like, oh, no, Bigfoot's a lot bigger than that. I'm like, oh, really? He goes, yeah, I've tracked Bigfoot. I'm like, oh. No kidding. Now, I'm thinking, you know, the jungles of Laos or somewhere
right.
in Vietnam. He goes, no, up in Death Valley. And I'm like, oh man, you got to tell me this story. So he told me this really intriguing story about tracking Bigfoot through Death Valley. And I'm like, wow, it just was so genuine and unforced and unexpected that it kind of triggered, like, well, I'll start looking around at different stuff, other stories. And going back in the newspapers, I found stuff, you know, where ranchers and cowboys and cattlemen were talking about it in the desert. And then how the Native Americans, the Serranos and the Paiutes and different ones would have a tradition of the hairy man or the giant elder brother that lived out in the desert. Now, so it had a long folklore along with what you would call conventional news reporting on it. Now, as far as like, well, what the hell is something that like that going to be eating, drinking, and sheltering
right.
in the
right.
desert? Now, here's the thing. When I say desert, a lot of people immediately think cactus and an endless landscape. But there's mountains in the desert. And
sure.
We do see black bear. And black bear don't live in the desert. They're moving between the mountain ranges. So when they're out on the flats, or crossing open land, you'll see them or see their track or encounter them. I mean, we still have people, you know, having their garbage raided even here in the desert. So conceivably, a creature or whatever could be living in the wilder upland, cooler areas and only crossing the desert floor when it's going someplace. Right, so that could be one explanation for how it could even be possible. Now, bringing us to tonight and the pictures I sent you, what happened was, and
wait, before you do that,
yeah,
address the question though that you intoned, but you didn't get back to. What would they be eating? Because assuming that walking across the desert, you consume a lot of calories. These are, you know, if we're talking about the Bigfoot of folklore and the image that we have in our head, that's a big body to be moving around. Even if it moves only in the cool of the night, that's still going to burn up a lot. So what would they be eating out in the middle of the desert?
Well, here's the thing. From a couple of sources I've heard that they eat rodents. Now, people don't know that in the desert, we've per square foot, per square meter of the desert, our rodent population is unreal. You know, we have ground squirrels, all sorts of rats, stuff like that. And there's been reports of people have seen them eating, you know, these. And when I say ground squirrel, I mean not like a chipmunk. We have those size, but I mean a huge squirrel-like size.
Right.
And I had one report where a guy said he had seen one eat 8 of those in one go. It had dug them up under rocks and then sat down and ate them, everything but the tail. So conceivably, it could find enough nourishment from a meal like that.
Sure.
Within an hour, 2 hour, 3 hours work for gathering it. Again, if it's moving from mountain range to mountain range, you know, up in the ranges, we've got deer and bighorn sheep and a lot bigger things that support a population of mountain lion.
But are there reports of coming across various carcass that people can't explain?
I myself have come across tons of dead sheep up in the hills, but you know, I would first assign it to a mountain lion,
right?
Before I, you know, it's the old thing. Unless I saw Bigfoot eating the sheep, I couldn't tell you, you know,
right?
But finding the carcass is like something ate it, so I would assume it was a mountain lion. If it was something other than that, well, that's a possibility too, I guess.
What about wolves? Do you get those? Or desert fox? What do you get?
We've got coyotes. We've got coy dogs, which are like a mix of dogs that's gone feral. We have fox. And supposedly we've got gray wolves in a few spots in the Mojave.
Okay.
Certainly super rare these days. Back in the 1800s, where there were a lot of animals and everyone seemed to shoot everything that moved.
Right.
We had all sorts of things. I mean, they even had jaguar and stuff like that that had come up from the Yucatan.
Wow.
Been in the southern areas of, like, you know, Texas, Arizona.
Right.
On over.
So then what about water? And again, and we'll get to the photos here in just a second, giving people time to get caught up by going to coasttocoastam.com,
sure,
clicking to desert strangeness / open lines, which we'll get to in a couple hours, and then going down, scrolling down, looking to related images, and you can see the photos that ML has collected just in the last, what, week? Photos that you took?
2 weeks.
Yeah. Okay, so would there be, this is a question I really, would they need to have a separate water supply if they were drinking, for example, if they were eating 8 squirrels, if a Bigfoot were eating squirrels, would that provide enough liquid nourishment for him to not require a water supply?
Now you're asking me like I'm an expert on this.
Well, I don't know what the tradition is.
But I would imagine that would not be nearly enough water.
Then where would be a water source?
You know, the West was pushed through by going water hole to water hole. You know, you could fill up a barrel and put it in your wagon and go, but most of the trails, roads, and development of the entire West was based on how far to the next water hole. So
right.
Animals are no different. We have lots of wild water holes and wilderness areas where, you know, you can't be in there after night because you'll scare the animals away from the water. They get a huge range of you know, animals out there drinking. So, it's hard to find. It is out there. And if you're out there, you're definitely going to need copious amounts of water.
Well, that's what I wanted to establish that because I think that's, with that as a background, then I think we can understand better the notion of traveling through the Mojave. If the hairy brother that lives out in the desert, or, you know, Yeti or Bigfoot or however we want to look at this, some sort of creature like that would leave footprints like the ones that you photographed this week, that we're not even, we can just check all the boxes that say, yes, survivable. and that we wouldn't, let's not even go down the road then, that, oh, this can't possibly be true because nothing could survive under those circumstances. We've established they can, and I love that. And so that's where we'll pick it up when the conversation continues in just a few minutes. M.L. Behrman is an expert on the Mojave, and he has been collecting Mojave mysteries ever since he bought a home and moved there. And his media from that is just, it's so fun and so comprehensive. We can get to some of the other stories, but we first have to get to then the photographs. You go look at them. We'll talk about them. And then at the top of the next hour, we'll open up the phones so that you can join the conversation a little bit early than we usually do on a Friday night, so that you can talk with ML Behrman and you can talk about those footprints and what you see in those photographs too on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, it gives you a tip of the hand to the upcoming theme for all the bumpers tonight. If you look at the photographs at coasttocoastam.com under our guest tonight, Desert Strangeness with ML Behrman, you'll see exactly why I picked that tune. Walk Like a Man, Sing Like a Girl. Of course, that was the formula for the Four Seasons, and I have no doubt that earlier this week somebody mentioned that Tommy DeVito died, the founder, actually. Well, co-founder, but I mean, one of the driving forces behind the Four Seasons died at 92, but a doo-wop king in his own right. It's always sad to think that we're losing so many people from that era who are left, because it was such a magical time for pop music. And yet we will always have, I think, a pretty good collection of those tunes as they've been remade and remade and remade, even by contemporary bands over the years. So we'll get back to ML Behrman coming up in just a second once you look at the Bigfoot photos, and then we'll get to your calls next hour on this subject. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Super nice to hear from John, who is a wildcat himself and grew up listening to Coast on KSAL in Salina, Kansas, who's listening tonight. And to Matt, who reached out to me on Twitter, at Deacon Punnett is my Twitter handle. And he was curious. He said, is this a show about Bigfoot or about unsolved mysteries, unlike unsolved murders? And I thought, okay, well, cool. How about unsolved murders by Bigfoot? That's a whole other topic right there. I look forward to that. But we were just talking about this. So I hope by now everybody's seen the photos. You go to coasttocoastam.com and click underneath the Tonight Show and you can see the link. So tell us the story about how you came across these photos that you took. And these are actually, you took two different sets, right? Because you found one and then you found others?
Yeah.
Okay.
Two different days.
So ML Behrman spending time in the Mojave and suddenly, whoops, there's footprints that look really weird.
Yeah, well, it was one of those things where I was going to look for something else. A friend had told me that a friend of his had said he had seen orbs in this one canyon. Now,
oh, cool.
Yeah. Now, out here, they're also called spook lights sometimes. And in the mining days, miners would see them, and they would sometimes, the superstitious ones would say, well, it's the ghost of a dead Indian shaman or murder victim.
Right.
Or they'd say it shows you where there is rare earth deposits under the ground, you know, uranium, thallium, stuff like that. And they would actually look for it. And then some people think it's actually a piezoelectric static discharge caused by granite grinding, you know, due to earthquake or a fault line.
Oh, interesting.
So anyway, he had told me down by the eastern Mojave, eastern central, by the Palin Mountains, that his friend had seen these up in this one ravine. So it was a 2-hour drive and then a 6-mile hike. So I thought, well, you know, I'll go do it. Now, we're in the middle of a heat wave, so it's like 110, 115.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, God, I'm going to wait and do it right before the sun goes down, and then I'll look at night.
Right.
So I get down there, I park my Jeep, I start down this old mining road, and like I say, it's like a 6.5-mile round trip up by foot, and I'm maybe 2 miles into it. The sun's just about down. I come down this long straight, and I see a Jeep has gone through within the last week. So obviously there was some human activity. And as I'm walking along, kind of daydreaming, thinking about how I was going to set up tonight, I had brought a thermal camera. I saw a line of tracks coming out of the desert to my right, crossing the road, and then continuing on. Now, at a distance, I could see they were pretty deep. And at first, I'm thinking, like, wow, I wonder if they got out of the Jeep and were, like, tromping around. But as I got up to it and right up to it, two things immediately. One, they weren't boot tracks. They looked like foot tracks with toes. And they were pretty deep, and they crossed the Jeep's tracks. So it had come across the road after the Jeep had passed. And I'm looking at it going, like, am I looking at what I think I'm looking at? Now, they weren't that big. They were like a size men's 10 or 11 maybe. And you can see one of the photos I sent in, I put my hand down just to show how big it was. And the stride was not that big either. You know, it looked like an average person, but with weird feet.
Now, back up for just a second. So if you had wanted to, you could have made that using just a normal human stride and maybe sandals on your feet. You could have replicated the first photo you found. Reasonably close.
Might have been hard, but yeah. Although it was deeper than I would imprint.
Oh, right, of course.
Now, so I did a circle around him, you know, to try and cut the trail and see where it came and went to. And it had come up out of this other rocky ravine and traveled about 20 yards, crossed the road, and then continued on up this wash into a big ravine I could see about a quarter mile away. So I was like, wow, you know, that's really weird. So I'm like, well, but I'm out trying to do something else, and I want to get to where I got to go before it gets too dark. So I took some pictures and moved on. And I got to the ravine I was shooting for, spent most of the night there, didn't see a damn thing, packed up. I'm coming out. It's about 3:30 in the morning, and I'm walking down this road, you know, with my headlamp on. And I had seen coyotes. I had seen a small bobcat, a big owl, you know, and countless scorpions and stuff like that. I mean, what you see in a normal night in the Mojave.
Right.
I got up to the tracks. I'm like, I wonder if it came back or something. And no, it was just the same tracks. I didn't see it. I shined my light all around trying to pick up some eye shine or something. Didn't
right.
see it. So I went back to the Jeep and I left, came home. A couple days later, you know, it just was bugging me man, those were so fresh. They were so sharp. And to see him there, you know, I got to go back and see if I can find him again and track him more or find something else. And I'm going to go earlier in the day so I've got daylight that I can actually try and track it. And I went back. It ended up being about 5-6 days later. I went back. And this time I didn't park and go on foot. I just drove in my Jeep since it was a Jeep trail. And I have the top off so I can hang out and go real slow and look.
Right.
And there had been enough wind and stuff that the first ones I had found had been pretty much obliterated. They were, you know, I couldn't really get much more out of them. And it looked like a Jeep had gone by within the last day or two also.
Huh.
So it had destroyed whatever tracks were on the road.
Right.
So I'm driving, and I get just maybe a quarter mile away, and I look down on the bank right next to me, and there is like a mama track. I'm like, whoa, am I looking at what I think I'm looking at? So I stop, jump out, go over, and that's the second set of tracks that you'll see in the photos.
In the road.
Yeah. Well, no, the one that has the water bottle next to it, that's the one. That's the one up on the bank.
Okay.
And that water bottle's a liter and a half bottle. It's 12 inches long.
Okay.
And that makes that track about 16 inches. And you can see it looks like toes and everything. And I went, wow, you know, that is a big foot. That's a big track.
Right.
And then I looked in the road. It stepped off the bank and walked up the middle of the road. And what struck me immediately, and you'll see in the photo, is the length of the stride between these tracks. And I measured it. It was almost 4.5 feet between, you know, from toe to heel.
Right.
And I actually tried to match it to the side, and I had to jump, really jump, to make it. And it had gone up the road a bit and then gone off the trail and then headed over towards the area where I'd found the first tracks before it petered out in some gravel bank that it was following, because it's easier to walk on hard gravel in the desert than sand. Now, here's something. When you said about water, what's interesting is both set of tracks were going towards that canyon that was off to the side of the one I had originally gone to. And I'm like, I wonder what's up that canyon. If they're going up there, I wonder if there's water up there.
Huh.
And I'll get back to the tracks in a sec. But I came home and I went on Google Earth, the satellite, which I always do. I found the spot. And I started following that ravine.
Right.
I saw there was like some really green brush up at the top of it in the side area where there must be water. So I was actually, when I talked to you this morning, I was getting packed to go out again, because I went and grabbed a trail camera because I want to hike up into that ravine to that water hole and set up a camera and see if I can see anything coming.
Yeah, like three of them from every angle.
that water. Now, back to the pictures. Now, I showed those to my girlfriend, who, God bless her, is, you know, a skeptic on most stuff, except the stuff she believes in. And she's like, you don't really think there's something that big out there. And I'm like, okay, let's approach it a little bit critical thinking.
Right.
Now, I'm 6'2", 250 pounds, with a size 13 boot. Now, that thing's foot was a lot bigger than my foot. It impressed a lot deeper than I do at 250 pounds. So give him 100 pounds. He probably weighs 350. Now, that stride is easily a third or more bigger than the stride I can do.
If you were trying, even,
if
probably.
If I was trying.
Right.
So give him a foot on height, you know, longer legs. So now you've got some guy out there that's 7 foot tall, 350 pounds, walking barefoot in that sand and choya cactus and, you know, sharp rocks and everything else.
Scorpions.
Yeah. Like, if that's a human, I don't want to meet that guy either.
Right. Right.
You know?
Like, yeah. You certainly don't want to meet him there.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, okay, hon, let's assume it is totally human. It's like, who is that human?
Right.
You know, what asylum did he get out of? And, you know, what is he doing out there?
And look at, and again, for people who go to coasttocoastam.com on tonight's Desert Strangeness link, and we're about an hour away from open lines, but we're going to get to your calls about this coming up in a few minutes. And go take a look at these photographs, because I think there are people who have either A, seen plenty of tracks themselves, who have phoned in or written in over the years on Coast, or people who have even done even more research and been part of expeditions and studied this sort of thing. We reached out to Jeff Meldrum at Idaho State. We couldn't find him. We think maybe he's out looking for Bigfoot this week, too. For all we know, he's on one of his expeditions as well, maybe shooting something for TV, or maybe it's just, you know, a crazy time at the university for him, like it is for everybody else. But whatever it is, there's insight in these photos. We just may not have all of it. But when you say that the way that Native Americans have told the story, or the old timers, you know, the old prospectors have told the stories to you, this sounds very consistent with this idea of a hairy brother in the desert.
Yeah. Some of the tribes view it as an animal just like a deer or a bear or something else. It's just part of the natural universe that happens to live side by side with them, and if they don't bother it, it doesn't bother them.
That are bipedal, though, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That are not like a deer walking around on hind feet, but
no,
this is.
And it's funny because one of the creation stories, and I don't want to name the tribe because I'll massacre their name, but supposedly the elemental animals were meeting with the Great Spirit when he was going to create man, and each one of them contributed something. Like the fish said he should be able to swim, the hawk said he should have good eyesight like me. The coyote said he should run on all fours like I do, but Hairy Man said, no, he should walk upright like I do on two legs. And that's how man came to be bipedal in this one Native American creation story, which I thought was fascinating. I loved that.
That would put him in kind of a missing link almost position between what we would, you know, for people who are Darwinists who would say, well, in the theory of evolution, at one point we didn't walk on our hind legs. We grew to do that, and our bodies morphed into the bodies that we have today. But in this sense, he was kind of that link between, because he's theoretically Hairy Man in the desert is still, quote unquote, unevolved. He's not in a tribe. He's still the original form that God would have created. In that story.
Yeah, in that story. And some tribes believe that he's a being between two worlds, you know.
Oh,
half
right.
Spirit, half.
Right.
And he only appears to impart a message or to confuse you.
I've heard this many times, yeah.
Yeah, that he leaves just so you can ponder the world and not think you're conceited enough to know everything.
Right.
Now, in the 1800s, you read the newspaper accounts, and if you go to my YouTube thing, you'll see the Cement Monster, the Cape Curiosity, the Rabbit Snatcher, different stories that are based on the old newspaper accounts that I show the actual article. They were more of like, hey, it leaves feet, it walks like a man, it's hairy, it must be some prehistoric man, or their favorite term, which I love, is the what is it? You know, it's like they didn't, you know, some were like, it must be an orangutan that escaped from a circus on the
coast. Right.
You know, stuff like that. And, so they treated it as a lot more of like what we see. It's like, wow, there's tracks, and someone saw something hairy, and, you know, the pigs are missing, or the
right,
you know.
You mentioned the pigs. We'll give the numbers at just after the top of the hour. But I actually do want to explore that. I want to pick at that a little bit, because you said the pigs are missing, and that chimes with something I was wondering about in terms of modern interactions with anybody who is doing any type of ranching. And have they ever encountered, and is there any stories about them co-mingling with humans and creating a new species? We'll get back to that coming up next with ML Behrman on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.